Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Stephen Greenblatt, who is the author of The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. Stephen Greenblatt is the author of Will in the World, 11 books in all, editor of 7 books, including The Norton Shakespeare, professor at Harvard University, one of the founders of New Historicism, which we'll talk about, and co-founder of the literary journal Representations. Also performed at one time with Monty Python before it was Monty Python, with members of it, and used to hang out with Art Garfunkel.
We were counselors at a camp one summer about 120 years ago.
And who did you perform with Monty Python?
My notion of performance would be exaggerated, too, in this account. I was a very minor member of a club at Cambridge University called the Footlights. But the Footlights had Eric Idle and several other of the people who went on to found Monty Python. But Eric was particularly my friend and still is my friend.
During the period, had you ever thought of getting into performing at all?
I didn't manage to ruin anyone's dreams of performance. I did think for a while in my life that I might like to be an actor. But I discovered, even before I discovered whether I had any talent or not, I discovered that I had a kind of passion for books. So they weren't compatible in Yale of early 1960s. That is to say, you had to make a choice of whether you were going to be a passionate student or a passionate theater person.
Well, before we get to The Swerve, one question then, because you're one of the world's leading experts on Shakespeare, is it possible for you to sit there and see a mediocre Shakespeare performance and go, you know, damn it, I could do a better job?
I generally don't say that to myself, but I've certainly seen my share of mediocre Shakespeare performances. But actually, what I experience then is not so much frustration. Even in a terrible Shakespeare performance, I almost always hear something for the first time that I didn't realize was there. And that's after a very long time of reading Shakespeare. One of the strange things about that particular playwright is that he can keep surprising you. Even in clumsy performances, he can keep surprising you.
Well, Stephen Greenblatt, let's talk about The Swerve, which has a small element of Shakespeare within it, in that Shakespeare was one of the recipients of the philosophy that you discuss in The Swerve, which is pretty much about how the Renaissance and the philosophies behind the Renaissance came to be and what happened thereafter, which is why the subtitle is How the World Became Modern. In particular, it's a story of Poggio Bracciolini, a lay person who worked in the Vatican, who was, of all things, a book hunter, and in searching for books, discovered a lost manuscript by a man named Lucretius, and that manuscript was copied and changed things. How did you come upon, first off, Lucretius, and secondly, Poggio, and what brought you to write a book about Poggio's search and what happened thereafter?
Here's how it began, Richard. I was an undergraduate at Yale, and at the end of the year, I would always go and rummage around at the Yale Co-op to see what books they had remaindered or on sale. They used to virtually give the stuff away to try to clear the stock. And I saw a copy, paperback copy, of a poem I didn't know, by an author I didn't know, namely On the Nature of Things by Lucretius. The paperback had a fabulous cover image by Max Ernst, the surrealist painter, of two sets of legs disembodied up in the sky doing something interesting, or so I thought. And I thought, this is a sexy cover. And it cost 10 cents at that time. 10 cents was not nothing, but I bought it for the cover, really. And then over the summer, I picked up the book, and I was hooked. And I was particularly hooked because I had that strange experience that people who love books occasionally have, which is that this book was speaking to me and speaking to me directly. I've held on to the connection to the poem ever since, and I love it.
And Poggio, how did you run across him?
Yeah, Poggio is a less likely candidate for this. I'd never heard of Poggio Bracciolini, but a few years ago I became interested in the idea of, or in case I was thinking about the idea of mobility, how things move around. What if you thought about cultures not as if any culture, not as if it in its natural state were deep rooted in a particular soil and every once in a while got disrupted by exile or war or whatever. What if you thought of cultures as always in movement? What would things look like? What would it look like to think about circulation and not about rootedness? because I was thinking about that, I thought to myself, because I've always loved this poem, when did this poem get circulated again on the nature of things? And I found, to my surprise, that this poem by Lucretius had fallen out of circulation for more than 1,000 years.
And at this point, you weren't thinking about a book. You were just doing research on your own?
Absolutely, just trying to think about the movement of things around the world, what it means for things to be stopped or stilled and then to move again.
And how does this fit in the context of the idea of new historicism, which links up culture and politics and history?
The idea of new historicism was that it wasn't the best idea in the world, in any case, to think of works of art as if they don't belong to places, as if they're completely isolated, as if you encounter them in a white box with no background, no context at all. So the notion of new historicism was, for those of us like myself who had been trained to read literature in a school of thought known as new criticism, and new criticism thought of works of art deliberately, thought of works of art taken out of their times and places. New historicism began to think not only what if you think of them in their time and place, but what if you think of your time and place in relation to their time and place? What does it mean for two different worlds to meet each other? And this poem, Lucretius, is an extreme instance of this because we have to start thinking about three places. You think of the ancient world, 2,000 years ago when this work was written. You think of our world, the modern world in which I first encountered this, and I thought, my God, this poem is speaking to me about my world. And then you also think about the moment at which this work, after being dormant in effect for more than 1,000 years, came back to the world.
Well, how did you find out that it was dormant?
Unlike certain schools of ancient philosophy, mostly Plato and Aristotle, those works, some parts of Plato and Aristotle, continued all through the Middle Ages and were actually quite important in formulating how Christians thought of their world. There's Christian Platonism, and even more, there's a powerful sense through Aristotle of Christianity shaped the thought of Thomas Aquinas. So you have traditions that way. In the case of materialism, atomism, of this world of Lucretius and of his teacher, Epicurus, you had an almost complete erasure. You had a period in which no one was talking this way about the world. And then one day, in January 1417, it came back all in one piece, in the piece of this astonishing poem.
So getting back to Poggio, okay, you're searching around. How did you find him?
If you look in books about how things came back from the ancient world, you keep finding references to this man. You find references to a number of different people. You find references to Petrarch. You find references to Bartolomeo of Montepulciano, and so forth and so on. You get a whole bunch of names. But one name keeps coming back over and over again, and that is Poggio Bracciolini of Terra Nuova. So you begin to ask yourself, who the hell is Poggio Bracciolini, and why is his name coming back? He found the text of Vitruvius. That's the great ancient theorist of architecture. He found the lost text of Quintilian. That's the great ancient theorist of rhetoric. And he found this, and he found many other things. So he's the greatest book hunter of the 15th century. So I simply started by trying to think, who is this guy? And then from there, I began to try to unravel the story of this person. There isn't a good modern biography of Poggio in English, but there's actually quite a good, very scholarly one in German by a man named Walser. So I started by reading this German biography of Poggio and then trying to figure out more about him and what he's about.
And at what point did you realize, wait a second, I can connect Poggio, Lucretius, and the rise of the Renaissance and my own thoughts about how cultures move into a book?
I think my moment of great excitement and my thinking that something could be done with this, so not necessarily a book yet, but something could be done with this, was when I realized that Poggio found Lucretius in the wake of a set of horrible and fascinating events in the early 15th century in Constance in southern Germany. What happened is that Poggio worked for arguably the worst pope in the history of the papacy, which is actually saying something. It's a long history. A very strange, very interesting, fascinating man, extremely sinister. By birth, he was Bartolomeo Cossa, his name was. And he came from a family of Neapolitan pirates, actually from a place called Procida in southern Italy. And then he himself was an ambitious young guy, this man Bartolomeo. He decided not to go directly into the family business of piracy, but to become a lawyer, which may be a good progression from piracy to law. And then from law, he decided to go into the clergy. And he rose through a succession of fascinating and sinister moves, higher and higher in the papal hierarchy, until he finally reached the highest position of all, namely Pope. And he called himself John the 23rd. The beginning of a connection for me, or the beginning of an interest for me, was when I saw that name, John the 23rd. I thought to myself, wait
That's
a minute.
Angelo Roncalli. Right?
I've seen that name, John the 23rd. John the 23rd was one of the heroes of my childhood. I mean, that seemed like one of the really wonderful people in my world. Angelo Roncalli found that name. No one had touched the name John the 23rd from the early 15th century when they, as we would say, took the jersey away from the Pope Cossa. They said, you are no longer the Pope, and that name, John the 23rd, is not yours. They put him in prison. No one dared to touch the name. The name was so poisoned. And then in 1958, Roncalli took the name, was a very daring act, took the name for himself and launched Vatican II and a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah, I was astonished at what a radical act it was when I read your book, The Swerve, Stephen Greenblatt. I had no idea. And then I'm going, this guy tried to transform Catholicism in 1958. That's quite a feat to take the name of this. He's called an anti-pope.
Yes, there's a series of figures in the history of the church who were or claimed to be popes. Either they were never acknowledged to be popes, or in the case of this man, who was actually the pope in the Vatican, Bartolomeo Cossa, was kicked out of office. Not only kicked out of office, he was thrown into a dungeon. He embarked on a very elaborate plea bargain. He admitted to a whole series of charges against him in exchange for dropping the 16 worst charges against him. But he admitted to murder, incest, simony. So it's actually hard to figure out what the hell he had done in those 16 charges, but no one has ever found them.
But he wasn't burned at the stake either.
On the contrary, he ended his life very handsomely in Florence, and his tomb, designed by no one less than Donatello, a great Renaissance artist, is in the baptistry in Florence. Meanwhile, Poggio, our guy, was out of work. And at that point, 14, 15, 16, he starts to do the thing that is deepest in his heart to do, which is to go book hunting.
Which is fascinating because I know all of these people who were book hunters or were book hunters, you know, go to estate sales and old bookstores looking for specific books. And then finding out that this goes back. I mean, he was in competition with other guys, other monks sometimes, to find the most obscure Latin texts they could. And, of course, there were several grails, of which this was one.
They were in search of fame and glory in their time. There weren't that many of them, but there were a number of them. And they were very clever. And they looked at what had survived from the ancient world, and they tried to catch names that were there that no one had seen. So Lucretius was one of them, but there were many others, names of writers or names of dialogues, works that at once had existed and once had been very important. For example, the greatest ancient Roman poet was named Ennius, E-N-N-I-U-S, and they all went searching for Ennius. And to this day, except for a few fragments quoted here and there, no one has ever found Ennius. But another such name was Lucretius, because the poet Ovid, whose work they knew, said that the verses of divine Lucretius will last as long as the world lasts.
Only they didn't.
Or they couldn't find any words by him till this moment.
A curious fact is that Poggio, even though he was looking for Lucretius, he didn't really care about the philosophy in it. In fact, his archenemy, Valla, cared more about the philosophy than he did.
Absolutely. Poggio, he's a fascinating man, but was very much determined not to be burned at the stake or imprisoned. He was rather careful and conservative that way, and probably by also instinct. First of all, he didn't see Lucretius for a while because his friend, he sent the copy to his friend Niccolò Niccoli to copy, and it took Niccolò Niccoli years to do so. And then when he encountered it, he was interested in it for its elegance, for the beauty of its poetry, for its vocabulary. But the ideas, not just to Poggio, but to almost everyone in Poggio's world, must have seemed either crazy or wicked or both. Valla is a wild exception in thinking, and of course Valla is a very daring man, Valla, who wrote the Donation of Constantine and blew the whistle on the church's claim to have an ancient stake in temporal rule. Valla's are very, very unusual. And likewise, Marsilio Ficino, who started to write a commentary on Lucretius, but when Ficino saw where the commentary was taking him, where the work was taking him, Ficino burned his commentary. So it's very dangerous to get too close to this too early.
This mentioned throughout the book, the swerve, that Valla and Poggio were enemies. But it seems as if you couldn't really find out why.
Oh, you can, I think, in this case, find out why. Valla, well, there might be reasons behind the official reason, but Valla made fun of Poggio's Latin, said he had some mistakes in Latin. And this was a world in which thems were fighting words, partner.
Really?
You couldn't insult anyone else's Latin in this world. So they were willing to kill each other over diphthongs and ablative absolutes. This was a matter of life or death for them. So Valla, who was a very funny guy, and Poggio too was a very funny guy, they were joke tellers, Valla made fun of Poggio's Latin. Poggio would have been very happy to kill Valla if he could have for that, and they remained lifelong enemies. You could say that what they're fighting over is prestige, respect, a sense of command of the past and of the present. Latin is not a minor part of their lives. It's the center of their claim to glory, fame, and also significance in their world and the Vatican court.
Well, they were also trying to get to the highest level that they could get to within the court, and
yes.
I guess they were in competition as well.
They were scrambling for prestige and power in the Vatican court. There was wealth at stake, but also really, I think it's important to take seriously, Richard, the sense that for them, Latin was the crystalline language of truth and beauty, and if you were told that you didn't have an adequate grasp of that, you were being told something very serious.
Let's talk a little bit about the philosophy, the Epicurean philosophy that's behind it and how that changed the Renaissance. Lucretius talked about atomism. He talked about the ultimate purpose of existence should not be worship or fear, but the pursuit of pleasure, though by pleasure he didn't mean orgies or too much food. He meant just the pursuit of happiness.
He didn't have necessarily moral objections to orgies or too much food. He just thought that they left rather nasty consequences and that, therefore, that probably wasn't the best way of pursuing pleasure.
But he also made fun of religion.
He didn't entirely make fun of it. He actually thought it was bad for you. He thought that it was a form of delusion. And he thought it was a form of delusion based on a set fundamentally of fears and desires that human beings shouldn't encourage in themselves. Fears and desires for something absolute, for something that you couldn't have, or fears of punishment that you needn't fear. That is to say, he thought that the priests of the world, he's living 50 before the Common Era, he thought that the priests of his world tended to traffic in anxieties that human beings have about misfortune and about death, and to tell humans that if only they do this and that, if only they sacrifice correctly, if only they speak to the gods correctly, they'll avert these punishments. Or alternatively, that they'll be rewarded forever in a happy place. And he thought this is not a good way for human beings to think.
Well, the attack on religion in that sense, I mean, the Catholic Church would not be happy with anything like that if it came out. So it's kind of understandable why it disappeared.
Not just the Catholic Church, but the Jews as well, and the pagans as well. Look, Lucretius said about 50 before the Common Era that the trouble with religions, he says, is that they always come back to a idea of sacrificing a child, and that there's something wrong with a form of thinking that comes back to child sacrifice. Now, he's thinking of Agamemnon and Iphigenia, probably. But as you can imagine, that didn't sit well 50 or 100 years later when an even more resonant story of the sacrifice of a child began to circulate in the world. So, of course, no, Christians didn't have affection for this school of thinking. But as I say, pagans and Jews didn't either. Ultimately, it was not atheistical. Lucretius said he believed in the gods. He just thought the gods were taking pleasure in themselves. It wasn't good for the practice of religion.
Well, it seems that he was doing something else as well, which the medieval church would not have looked kindly on, which was just simply questioning the conventional wisdom of his time, and that anybody who read his book would see the connection with questioning the conventional wisdom or the forced wisdom of their time as well.
I think it's true that he didn't pay homage to any of the official lines of his world. You think of writing in 50 before the Common Era, this is the world of gladiatorial games, it's the world of visions of the afterlife in Rome, it's the world of visions of duty and obedience. He doesn't actually take these at face value. And I think that he becomes a model for what it is not to live within the official ideology of your time. And therefore, of course, he is called into question. Although he wrote beautifully, that's the trick of this, Richard. He's a fantastic poet. And he himself writes that his master, Epicurus, does not believe in poetry. Epicurus believed in writing philosophy in good, plain, homespun prose. But Lucretius said he wants to write this philosophy in poetry. It's like honey smeared around the lip of a cup, and it will enable you to drink with pleasure something that might otherwise taste a little bitter.
It also means that by virtue of being beautiful poetry, there's a greater chance of surviving because it's got the aesthetic as well as what's behind it.
Exactly. And this is exactly what happened in the early 15th century. When this came back, people didn't become excited by this work because they thought, oh yes, atoms and emptiness and the soul dies. That's very interesting. They embraced it with excitement because it has some of the most beautiful poetry, an unforgettably beautiful hymn to Venus, a beautiful account of the way the world is, a beautiful account of sex, very powerful consolation in the face of death and so forth that they had ever seen.
Eventually, when Poggio brought it back and gave it to his friend Niccoli, you got a kind of situation that reminded me of Samizdat in the Soviet Union, people copying this manuscript and giving it to their friends so they could all pore over it, but the official world would not necessarily be aware of it.
At first, the official world was not hostile, so much so that when Gutenberg came along later in the 15th century with his clever little invention, printers began to print copies of Lucretius, and not only did they print them, but they printed them for the schools with very elaborate commentaries, scholarly commentaries. So it was only in 1506, almost a century after the work came back in 1417, that the Florentine Synod looked at this and said, this is not a suitable book for the schools. We'll ban this book from the schools, and we'll fine anyone who tries to teach it. That was very bad for the publishing industry because they had already printed a lot of copies of this work. But once it's out in print, or even, as you say, in the Samizdat, it's extremely difficult to stop.
Now, Stephen Greenblatt, what happened after that is astonishing because what Lucretius did by forcing people to question is they began thinking about things like science, as well as the idea that, you know, perhaps religion wasn't the be-all and end-all. And it was science and the arts, humanities, that changed the world and created the Renaissance.
Yes, it's true. Of course, there were always people who thought about science, always people who thought about the natural world. They were great medieval scientists. But what happened was that the set of presumptions or assumptions about the world that Lucretius reintroduces into the world turned out to be immensely generative. They turned out to have very, very long legs. And once people like Galileo began to think in these terms, it turned out that it was possible to think about the world in extremely interesting ways. Lucretius acknowledges several times in his work that there are phenomena whose explanations he does not understand, but he believes that there will be a rational explanation found for them, and that's the key move. In other words, he has ideas as to how earthquakes might happen or how thunder and lightning happen. He's willing to imagine that his explanation is wrong, but there must be a natural explanation. You can't fall back on the notion that it's being done by a mysterious transcendental force, God or demon or whatever. And that's crucial. If you think that there are many things out there whose workings you do not understand, but are ultimately subject to human understanding, you're in a completely different universe from the universe in which you withdraw to the sense that we roll our eyes up to the heavens and say, oh, altitudo, oh, highest thing, and don't ask any further questions.
By the time we get to Descartes or even Leibniz, we're still talking about 100 or 200 years between the time Lucretius is rediscovered, which means that during that time there had to have been a lot of talk about what he was saying. So by then, I would guess the commentary they weren't just getting the manuscript, but they were getting the discussions about the manuscripts as well.
Yes, but the discussions were often very cautious, and they were often attached to warnings, a version of kids don't try this at home. This is not a set of beliefs that you need to have. You can enjoy it for the beauty of its poetry and so forth. Now, sometimes those warnings are a kind of cover for intellectual engagement. It was dangerous. Giordano Bruno, who was the first intellectual bravely to encounter and embrace these ideas, to say, look, I believe that the world is not the center of the universe, that there must be multiple worlds out there. There are other planets, there are other stars, that we're just matter in a vast universe. Giordano Bruno was taken out to the Campo dei Fiori in Rome and burned at the stake. You couldn't do this for a very long time. You had to be careful. Galileo, who embraced certain ideas of atomism in that earlier work called The Assayer that he published, found that the church had difficulty reconciling atomism with the idea of transubstantiation, and he paid the consequences for that, and so forth. It's dangerous for a long time. And you can feel the danger precisely in the period you're talking about, in the 17th century, with figures like Pascal or Descartes or Leibniz. And it's really only in the later 17th century with Newton and in the 18th century that you can get people who begin to talk more openly about the implications of these ideas.
Stephen Greenblatt, getting back specifically to your book, The Swerve, by telling the story of Poggio and Lucretius, we go into side trips. We learn about libraries, the history of libraries. We learn about different philosophies. We learn about what life was like in monasteries. We learn about what life was like in Florence, as well as the artistic life, too. Each of these little side trips form part of the whole. So let me ask you, what was the weirdest, strangest side trip you began taking? And maybe was there any that you took and decided, nah, I can't put this in the book?
Well, there are, first of all, many side trips that are not in the book. The book was originally about a third longer. I decided, in effect, that I shouldn't have side trips at all. What you're calling side trips are, for me, part of what I think is not a detour, but is part of the road that you need to travel down if you want to understand how it was possible for something to get lost for such a long time and then to come back, and what it means for something to come back into a different world. But of the things that I tried to learn, perhaps the strangest thing had to do with how it was in a monastery in the Middle Ages. If you found yourself being a scribe and working in that space they called a scriptorium, a place to copy manuscripts, how did you get the books to copy? Now, a lot of the time, the books were just given to you by the librarian, and that's what you had to do. But you had certain liberty of choice. And what I found out, and I think it was in some sense one of the most interesting pieces of this, was there was a system for requesting books. If you wanted a Christian book, these are silent places, the scriptoria. You weren't going to talk and disturb other copyists. And besides, it was part of the discipline of the medieval scriptorium to be silent. But you went to the librarian, you made the sign of a cross with your fingers. And with that sign of a cross, you would be given a good Christian book, a book of hours, a hymn book, or whatever. If you wanted a pagan book and you were on good terms with the librarian and he wasn't going to try to make you unhappy, you could do something. And there was a system of signs. You could scratch behind the ear as if you were scratching a louse. And if he was willing to recognize that sign and honor your request, that scratching of the louse would mean you'd be given a pagan book, but a pagan book of some solidity and something that wasn't too threatening. But if you wanted to get a less respectable pagan book, not something by Plato or Aristotle, let's say, but something much more disturbing, you could put your fingers in your mouth and make the sign as if you're gagging. And then if the librarian liked you, you would get something else. And what must have happened way back in the 8th century or 9th century to create the text that Poggio eventually found was that some monk somewhere must have made the equivalent of a gagging gesture and received Lucretius's poem to copy.
And the person who gave it to him may have had no idea what the hell he was giving.
Absolutely.
It was just
not
just another scroll in the library.
Probably stored in some part of the library's collections in which they stored pagan books rather than good Christian books. But they did keep them. That's the fascinating thing, is that the monasteries, in not in a systematic way, but in a nonetheless in a way that was momentous for the rest of human civilization, in a world in which the schools had shut down, the libraries had shut down, the copying had ceased, the monasteries kept copying some of these texts at least.
So it's possible, we don't know, but it's possible that, you know, they saw a crumbling manuscript that would never have lasted another 50 years, and the head librarian went, scratched his head and said, yeah, well, we kind of need a new copy, not even thinking about what it might or mightn't be.
Absolutely. That's precisely what I think is likely to have happened. I don't think that they had a systematic determination to keep X or Y going, but I think that they believed that they understood that if you didn't keep copying these things every few hundred years, they would disintegrate. And there are amazing descriptions of these manuscripts falling into mold and ruin before they're recopied. So everything had to be copied. Everything that reached us had to be copied. And if something particularly wasn't copied in the 9th century because of the amount of time that needed to pass, if something didn't make it through the 9th century when there was a brief revival of interest in this ancient world, it probably wouldn't make it into the modern world.
Some manuscripts survived over in Islamic world too, right?
Yes, not anything from this tradition that survived in the Islamic world, except for a very important history of philosophy that was written by an ancient Greek named Diogenes Laertius, which did survive in the ancient world. But yes, in fact, most of the corpus, I think, of Aristotle comes via the Islamic world. Most of our knowledge of Aristotle comes from the Islamic world. Some Aristotelian texts that survived in the West, but many came from the Islamic world. And of course, medieval Islamic thought was responsible for the passing along of a lot of the ancient heritage.
And that would have been possibly through Spain when the Moors took over Spain.
Either through Spain or through the East, through the great libraries in Egypt, in what is now Iraq, or in Turkey.
And information you were looking for that you didn't find, I would guess the number one piece was where the hell Poggio found that manuscript.
Yes, it's maddening, but Poggio, probably because he was, as we said earlier in this interview, in fierce competition with his friends to find these things, Poggio never left, at least in any surviving letter, the name of the monastery, probably in Germany, where he found this manuscript of Lucretius. When he went to a monastery with another friend, as they sometimes went in groups, then we do know the names. In this case, he went by himself, and he probably decided, like a prospector in the days of the 49ers, to keep his claim to himself.
Well, also because that means who knows what else is in that monastery as well.
Exactly. I think he thought he would go back, see what else he could find, but he probably didn't go back.
And information you found that you didn't expect.
Well, there's a lot that I didn't expect. In fact, much of the book, I have to say, was a huge pleasure precisely because it was the satisfaction of an almost boundless curiosity. But I didn't expect to find a complex world around Poggio Bracciolini with other people, other book hunters. I didn't expect to find the richness of the world of his Florentine master, Coluccio Salutati. I didn't know anything about the sinister Bartolomeo Cossa, his papal leader. I know even now all too little about the very complex history of reception of this text in the world that came afterwards. Each of these things has been an enterprise of discovery.
In terms of the absolute biggest surprise, was there any that just changed your world?
For me, the single biggest surprise is the one that I talked about at the very beginning, which was the shock of the initial encounter. And I'm someone in my life, Richard, who's subject to this from time to time, because I remember in my freshman year in college reading Chaucer in a freshman English class and thinking to myself, my God, they had irony back then in the 14th century? So a little bit probably is an expression of my naivete. But I felt then, and I feel now, even decades later, the shock that there was 2,000 years ago, already a powerful, fully articulated argument that the universe doesn't need intelligent design, that you don't have to fear death and punishment after death, that everything comes into being because of a tiny swerve, random in the atomic structure of the world. I remain shocked that this existed 2,000 years ago.
What shocked me was just out of the blue, and you don't really go into it in too much detail, natural selection. He thought about natural selection.
He did. Really, all of this stuff, if you can think about this, all of this comes from just using your brain enormously powerfully when you're looking at a beam of sunlight, looking at the dust motes dancing in it, thinking, what follows from this if the universe is like this, if it's random motion that it lies behind all of this? And one thing that follows from this, he thought, was that the random motion is probably what produces anything that exists accidentally, and that if it's a living thing, he thought, if that living thing, that species, can find food for itself and can find a way of reproducing, it might last in the world for some time, but it's not going to last forever. And in fact, I'll give you, Richard, the biggest surprise for me in that part of Lucretius's thought. He had a further thought about natural, what he didn't call it, natural selection. He says, look, this must mean that the eyes don't come into existence in order to enable you to see. No one made the eyes for you to see. If what we would call a set of mutations, random mutations, means that a creature comes along that is able to see, and it turns out being able to see enables you to get food and reproduce, that will be reproduced. But it wasn't made for that reason. Now, even now, in the 21st century, that's a piece of natural selection theory that's the hardest for us moderns to get hold of, that the things that look like they're created in order to produce a certain thing were the results of accidental transmutations that enabled us to do the things and therefore enabled us to survive, but weren't created for that purpose. It's fantastic that someone had thought that through 2,000 years ago.
Stephen Greenblatt, at the beginning of the interview, you talked about the three times that connect up, Lucretius' time, Poggio's time, and our time today. And, of course, I think writing a book like The Swerve or reading it brings a lot of what's happening today up. Antiquarian book hunters, I didn't know they went back to like 1300 A.D. But also, not long ago, there was some exposés, if you want to call them that, on people like Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann and their dominionist religion. And Bachmann herself, I believe, said at one point about how awful the Renaissance was. And I'm thinking, are we back to that these days?
Yes, well, there's two things I think I want to say about this. One, Richard, is that if you actually think of the fundamental principles of Lucretius's De Rerum Natura and what it gave to the world, that there's just atoms and void and nothing else, that the soul dies along with the body, that the universe has no creator or designer, that everything comes into being because of a swerve, that no one is intending all of this for us, that we're not going to be punished or rewarded in an afterlife. No politician in our country, Democrat or Republican, could run on that platform, even though not only has that platform been around for 2,000 years, but it probably forms the core of what most scientists in the world think must be the foundational principles of their work. So that is fascinating, that there's a disconnect between those foundational principles, which are both ancient and modern, and what any of our public figures can say. And then to that, you add the, to me, quite disturbing fact that several, at least, of our major political figures who have, after all, a significant shot — the world is a big place and full of people with crazy ideas — but people who have a shot at actually being our leader, Rick Perry is one, Michelle Bachmann is another, Rick Santorum is another, have explicitly said that they think that evolution is a theory and so is intelligent design, and those theories should just both have a place in the classroom. As if the word theory could simply collapse what scientists believe now into what medieval theologians believed, and it's all one thing. As if you would teach heliocentrism, the idea that the sun is at the center of the earth, and geocentrism, the idea that the earth is at the center of the earth, as two different interesting competing theories. Let's have them both in our astronomy classes. I find it amazing that in 2011 we're still having this argument 2,000 years after Lucretius wrote his poem.
Well, as if somehow science and religion are one and the same if you look at them in different angles, and yet they're spreading that on Twitter, which is there because of science.
Well, it is fascinating. And, of course, maybe it's a good thing. We can separate out our technology, even if the technology has been based on these discoveries. We can have an MRI. We can do gene splicing at the same time that we can deny all of the principles on which that technology has been developed. And that is, of course, what enables this very strange public moment we're in to exist.
From you as someone who studies history and culture, can you do any prognostication, or are you as much in the dark as the rest of us?
I'm probably in the dark along with the rest of us, but I do think soberingly from doing this work that it's possible for a whole culture, through its strange place that it's in, through its political leadership or absence of political leadership, to its loss of faith in itself and in reason, it's possible for a whole culture to turn away from its most progressive ways of thinking. So that's the sobering side of this. It did happen for more than 1,000 years that this way of thinking went under, wasn't seen, and it just the fantastic accident of this text surviving that this came back. On the other hand, I have the happy antidote to that thought, which is that very dark things can happen, but human beings are surprising. They're surprisingly intelligent as well as surprisingly stupid. And every once in a while, remarkable advances take place, and when you least expect them to take place.
One other element I came away from the book is realizing how impermanent our current culture is, particularly more impermanent now with everything being digital. If you shut down electricity, how many books will be lost, say, 50 years from now when they stop printing them?
We basically made a decision, like most of our decisions, it's not actually consciously made, but it's in effect made, that we will get a form of accessibility and the great circulation of a kind that would have been unimaginable in our childhood, let alone in any preceding generation. We're going to embrace that at the cost of endurance. The reason that we have Lucretius's On the Nature of Things is that 300 or 400 years after a text had fallen out of circulation, when it came back, people could still read it. Can you imagine our reading any of our digital technology 300 or 400 years if there was a break? Absolutely not. I can't read the texts that I wrote on my K-Pro that I used when computers first came in. They're on floppy disks. Maybe a NASA scientist could figure out how to read them, but I can't read them. If we ever become unplugged, as you say, it's going to be fantastically difficult to get back to our data. And I think if we only had digital data and someone came along with this thing called a book in which the words could last for hundreds of years after anyone had stopped reading them, we'd say, that's a very interesting idea. Let's see if we can hold on to that for a little bit.
Well, when you consider that most silent films are gone now, the holy grail of Roger Ebert, which is the Orson Welles cut of Magnificent Ambersons, color TV shows that were filmed on videotape in the 50s and 60s, some of them exist in black and white, but not color. Things that are made 10, 15 years ago, gone forever. The impermanence is striking, actually.
I mean, nothing lasts forever, Richard. We know that. In the great forever, nothing is around forever. But it would be nice if it's a few hundred years, is all I want.
That's my thought. Stephen Greenblatt, have you begun working on something else yet?
I have. I've been working on, but I'm at a very early stage, of a book about why humans tell stories and what the impulses of narrative are. And I've been thinking, I was in South Africa this summer in the end of August, and I've been thinking about those strange and absolutely compelling and marvelous Bushmen paintings, rock paintings from several thousand years ago, and what they tell us about the human storytelling impulse.
You've been listening to an interview with Stephen Greenblatt, whose latest book is The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.